Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There are 60s and 70s classics such as The Servant and Cross of Iron, documentaries like Amazing Grace and Becoming Bond, or how about Settling Down with Some Action with Ben Wheatley's Free Fire or Arnold Schwarzenegger in Raw Deal. Also on there, you'll find the final cut edition of Francis Ford Coppola's Vietnam movie masterpiece, Apocalypse Now. We covered the film all the way back in our very first episode. Now though, in a very special episode of Studio Canal Presents, we're celebrating the brand new 4K restoration of 1991's Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse. Now, I was in my teens when I first watched this extraordinary documentary, a warts and all look at the making of Apocalypse Now. And it's one of the most incredible movie stories ever committed to film. Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse is directed by Fax Barr, George Hickenlooper and Eleanor Coppola. It was famously assembled from the behind-the-scenes footage that Eleanor Coppola shot, as well as her audio recordings and written notes. Fax Barr's approved the new 4K restoration of the film. And not only is it, for my money, one of the best films about the making of a movie, it's now arguably the most lovingly restored as well. For this special episode then, we start with, and how about this, Francis Ford Coppola himself. The multi-Oscar winning director was speaking to us in London for the new release. And we started by asking him the story of how Eleanor came to document the making of Apocalypse Now in the first place.
Well, I had a rule, because I had these wonderful children, that if I was going to go away for a week or something, I would do it. But if it was 10 days, I took all my kids out of school and took them with me to wherever I was going, which in the case of the Philippines for Apocalypse Now. And of course, you know, your kids are game to get taken out of school and put into whatever. Sophia was 4, I put her in a Chinese school, so she was a little kid, and everyone was speaking Chinese and Tagalog, which is the Philippine language. So that was all right, because the movie company itself was like uncles and aunts, and Sophia would, you know, go, and the costume department would make her doll clothes, and Roman would spend his time with the special effects department, so he'd come to dinner with one eye hanging out. And so the kids were very much comfortable with this arrangement of getting pulled out of school. But my wife, of course, had friends and things she was doing, so that was a big, you know, what was she going to do? And knowing that she was such a talented person and good handheld camera person, I put a 16mm camera, which I bought for her, and said, you can shoot a documentary of us making the film, which is she famously did.
On March 1st, I came to the Philippines with Francis and our three children, Gio 12, Roman 10, and Sophia 4. Francis has asked me to make a documentary film for the United Artists Publicity Department. I don't know if he wants to avoid the addition of a professional team on an already overloaded production, or if he is just trying to keep me busy. The heat and humidity are overwhelming. It is the first time any of us have seen water buffalo, rice paddies, and nipa huts. Sophia said, it looks like the Disneyland Jungle Cruise.
It's something to do if suddenly we're going to all be living in the Philippines. She didn't just want to take care of the kids, which was never sort of our arrangement. So she started shooting this film. And this is a pretty funny situation, because Apocalypse Now was going very hard on me. I even though I had such successful two Godfathers, no one wanted to sponsor it. I myself had to, in order to make it, I had to guarantee any overages, which it immediately was going into. So I was not only making this film I didn't know how to make, I was also guaranteeing the budget, which was going up. And I would come home to my and see my wife, and I'd say, oh, sweetie, I don't know, I'm going to really fail in this movie. I don't know, You know, it's not going well, it's terrible, it's going to be the worst film ever made. And, and hoping she would say, oh, darling, I believe in you. No, no, she'd say, would you put a microphone on and say that same thing into the camera? So I did, you know. I put the microphone on and said, boy, you know. But everything I was saying in such negative terms was to my wife, who I wanted to, hoped would say, oh, well, I believe in you. You know, even after the shooting, I wanted her to say, well, we got that, that was good, but don't worry, Franz, I believe in you, or something positive. But she never did. She had ceased being the supportive wife and had become the documentarianist. And that's what it was like throughout the whole film. I had this in my home. I had someone who knew everything that was going on, because of course she was my wife, and she was recording all of this and seeing this immense scale of a movie basically out of control, and with me doing my best to hang on and hold it together.
My greatest fear is to make a really shitty, embarrassing, pompous film on an important subject, and I am doing it. I confront it. I acknowledge, I will tell you right straight from the most sincere depths of my heart, the film will not be good.
Her material and the material she shot covered the entire arc of this disastrous project. And she, at the time, she was also writing her notes, which became a book. And it was, in fact, my idea to suggest that she be the narrator of the film. And when her colleagues who were going to edit the project, because they brought in a team that knew how to direct and make documentaries, they suggested just having an actress perhaps read my suggestion, which was her notes. I said, no, let you do it. You know, your voice would be much more powerful.
Everyone who has come out here to the Philippines seems to be going through something that is affecting them profoundly, changing their perspective about the world or themselves. While the same thing is happening to Willard in the course of the film, something is definitely happening to me and to Francis.
You know, my belief in general in all art is, you know, that make it as personal as you can. Because if you make art that's really personal, it will be unique. Because everybody, you know, you're sitting there, it was a million to one shot that your parents were going to get together. And so you are all people who wouldn't exist. And the fact that you exist, there's only one like you. So if you make art that's like that, that art will then be unique, which is what you want with art. You don't want art to be the same as everybody else's. So Eleanor's film, Hearts of Darkness, which is really considered one of the two or three greatest documentaries about a film being made, the other one being Fitzcarraldo, whatever that's called, Burden of Dreams, I think it's called. And then the one that was made about the Don Quixote film that was never made. There are three great documentaries. So, of course, I'm very proud of Eleanor for that achievement.
The conversation then moved on to explore what Francis felt about the editing of the film, some of his memories, and just revisiting some of the footage.
So we owned and controlled the project because I had financed it. And my attitude was I wanted it to be honest, but there was a moment in the film that bothered me is when Martin Sheen had the heart attack, we were all devastated because he was a big smoker, and he was also, at the same time of being a big smoker, he would do this real workout every morning of a run. Well, he had the heart attack during that, so no one knew what was going to happen. And I mean, he could easily have in 2 weeks have died. And we were, number one, concerned about that, aside from the movie. But people started phoning home in the crew saying, oh, have you heard, you know, Martin Sheen had a heart attack, and that was tantamount in some recipients who got it that he died. So I got very upset, because if he did die, or even the same, if the rumor was out there that he had died, the film was in a very perilous state, because the people who had financed the first amount, I was responsible for the rest, would have just basically collected the insurance. The film would never be finished, and my part that I had done, which was everything I had, I would get wiped out. So I got very angry and I said to the crew, you know, Martin is had a heart attack, but he's under care now and we are hopeful of his recovery. And I don't want anyone saying that Martin has died unless I say it. I mean, I was afraid more of the rumor. And that it came off in the documentary as really unfeeling, which was not the case. I was really, I was very fond of him. But I was also in a tough position that there were all these rumors that he had died. And his wife, she knew that if the heart attack was too serious to the point of where he might die, that he'd never act again because he could never get insurance again. So I knew that. And so I said to her, look, let's just take him to the best hospital in the world, wherever it is. But don't say that he's not going to be in the picture anymore. And I will keep shooting with his brother, but I'll shoot it all in longer shots. In other words, I never stopped shooting and I never said that he died or he was out of the picture. And because his wife loved him so much, she knew that he loved being acting, and that if she pulled him out and said he's out of the picture, that he'd never get an insurance policy again, and he would not be able to act anymore. So because she did that, and you know, I mean, but the reason she did it is great love and admiration for him. But that's what made, so we never said that he was out of the picture, so we kept shooting. And eventually, he did come back. And I told you that story because there was only one part of the film that I didn't want in, which is when I said, Martin Sheen is not dead unless I say he's dead, because it sounded as though I didn't care, but I did care. So, as I said, I controlled the movie. It was when I owned it. But I wanted it to be honest, and I wanted it, and I wanted Eleanor not only to be the one who assured that the movie would be a form she wanted, but it would be guided by her voice, her actual voice, and notes guiding us through the picture.
Francis is in a place within himself, a place he never intended to reach, a place of conflict, and he can't go back down the river because the journey has changed him. I was watching from the point of view of the observer, not realizing I was on the journey too. Now I can't go back to the way it was. Neither can Francis. Neither can Willard.
One of the reasons why the film is so effective is that it's so personal. I mean, it's really her speaking, her words that she wrote in her voice, telling how she felt about her husband in this daunting situation, which was, you know, really became a sort of life or death situation, not only for me, but for our family, for our kids, the whole, you know, landscape of our lives together.
Francis then told us what it was like working on both Hearts of Darkness and Apocalypse Now at the same time.
Well, the two projects were being edited at the same time, and Apocalypse Now, as a movie, the movie part, as opposed to, so the documentary, my guidance was that Eleanor should make it as personal as possible. And unlike the other filmmakers working with her, who, you know, they just were regular documentarian guys, you know. So I wanted it to be her film, which it was, which it is. But Apocalypse, of course, what had happened was, when you make a film that you don't know how to make, and I deliberately like to make films I don't know how to make, because I had made two Godfather films at that point. I didn't want to make any more gangster pictures. Why? Because I knew how to make them. I like to make films I don't know how to make. Why? Because when you don't know how to make a film and you listen carefully, the film tells you how to make it. And Apocalypse Now was telling us how to make it, me and my colleagues. And it was telling me to make the film more and more surreal. So by the time the film got to the end, it was not the kind of typical Guns of Navarone war film. It was a Vietnamese sort of West Coast film on acid and drugs. Not that I was on those things, I wasn't, but a lot of the people and the actors were, and the film had become very surreal. So when Brando arrived at the end to play the character at the end, he's a brilliant person. He looked at, you know, what I was explaining to him, and he said, well, it looks like you painted yourself into a corner, because the film had become so surreal that just a big battle scene, the way the script was, wouldn't be the end. It needed a surreal ending. and the question is, what the hell was that? There never had been a film that was a West Coast rock and roll war movie. Usually movies were always guys from Brooklyn, and you know, these were LA people smoking dope and using LSD and sending off smoke grenades just because it was beautiful. And how was that going to end? So while we were struggling to finish the documentary of Hearts of Darkness, I was really struggling to figure out an ending and cut the ending of the film myself. You know, over was the first electronic editing system, and I would just stay up all night and cut the ending and cut the ending until I discovered something that I thought was a suitable ending.
Eleanor Coppola died in April of 2024, and as our time with Francis came to a close, we asked him how would he like Eleanor to be remembered.
Eleanor was, I don't know anyone who didn't love her, because for one thing, if someone was sick, if someone was dying, she would be there holding their hands. And in fact, what I do now, I'm here in London partly because I don't want to be somewhere where I'm was living with her, because if she's not having coffee with me and telling me stuff, then I don't want to. But the great Marcus Aurelius said that when you lose a loved one, the best thing you can do is to honor them by trying to be more like them. So now, like, I have lots of friends who are my age, as you can imagine, who don't have grandchildren or just alone, or their grandchildren don't pay any attention to them. So I call them up. I'm not like that, you know. I call them up and say, how are you? Are you all right? Has anyone visited you today? But I'm being like her. And by being more like her, I feel that I have the solution of how to keep her alive in my life by being like her. And if someone, you know, I do things that I know she would do, and by doing that, she resonates in my, I'm making her part of my actions that way, because I don't have her for real, which I wish I did.
Huge thanks to Francis Ford Coppola for sparing his time. For the second part of this episode, we then chatted to co-director Fax Barr about his experiences of Hearts of Darkness and just how he feels about it now. I'm delighted to welcome Fax Barr to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Hello, Fax. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to meet you, Simon.
Well, it's nice to meet you too. Now, one of the two people in this conversation co-directed Hearts of Darkness, a filmmaker's apocalypse. And spoiler, it wasn't me at all. Fax, I mean, it's quite a project, that is. That's quite a sentence to have as part of your career. You must get asked this a lot, but given your background, as I understand it, you created the TV show Mad TV, and I look at the work that you've done. In the notes, he says, I never would have guessed in a million years this would end up on your plate. How did, I mean that in full courtesy as well. I mean, you've done a really broad range of things. How did it come to you?
Early on in my years in Los Angeles, I was working, shooting electronic press kits for a guy who did all of Spielberg's films, and he was sort of connected into the studio system. And so, you know, these are 10-minute pieces, and you do perfunctory interviews with the actors. And he had just read Eleanor Coppola's notes and said, man, they talk about all this footage that she shot. Have you ever heard of a documentary being done? And I said, no. And he said, I'm going to call Zoetrope. So he did. And they were like amazingly receptive to us coming in to talk about it. And they were like, yeah, we tried to cut it before. And some of the footage really isn't very good. They were pretty disparaging about it. I don't think they'd even really seen the footage. This is just what they'd heard from the editing room.
Yeah.
And so we looked at some of the reels and I was like, oh my God, this is fantastic what Ellie did. And this was 89, like 10 years after the film had been released. So I cut together a little reel and took it out, and people were like, yes, let's do this.
Can I ask a question that might be verging towards the impolite?
Of course. I love impolite.
How old were you at this point?
30.
So at 30 years old, you rang Zoetrope. Was there any pre-existing relationship with Zoetrope? Or was it a case of you rang them cold and expressed interest?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
We just called them. I think Zoetrope was always, I mean, if you know anything about the company, it was always an open door.
Of course.
Right? I mean, they had people in San Francisco when they first started, you know, street people were walking in who had never been on a set before. And they were like, okay, you want to be a sound person? Here you go. Here's a Nagra. Figure it out. So they were very open to filmmakers. I think Francis has always been that way. And so we were welcomed in.
If they were open to filmmakers, you can't have been the first person to ask the question of looking at something to do with Apocalypse Now, appreciating that moment where you discovered that there was all of this footage. I mean, what was, like, I don't know, the second meeting with them like? You talked there about a reel, for instance, you cut together. Once you've got through the door, how did you get your foot stuck in it?
I'd written a synopsis of what I thought the documentary could be, which they liked very much. And I think Francis said, okay, that's a take that we could get behind. So they were pretty supportive all the way through. It was never like, prove to us, cut something and we'll see if we want to go forward. They were like, yeah, go for it, you know. So we felt fully supported, and we didn't have to barge our way through the door. It was open.
And had you made a documentary before at this stage? Had you written a synopsis for a documentary, for instance?
Yes, I'd written some synopses, but I'd never made a documentary before this.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story.
I'd made behind the scenes, you know, little EPKs and that kind of thing, but never a feature doc.
So that was the late 80s then. You get through the door at Zoetrope, you cut together a proof of concept, you write the synopsis, and then they say go. And if I've got this right, most of your 1990 was spent sat in a room working through reels of film and crying a lot. Would that be a fair... I mean, is that roughly where we were?
Oh, you fly on the wall there. Yeah, it was... I mean, it was 80 hours of footage, plus all of the outtakes that we saw, and there was just a ton of material to log. So that was, but it was exciting too. It was wonderful to see this stuff and to think about how it would fit in. And I did have my outline worked out, and I was sort of figuring out which chunks would go where and how the story would flow.
I could imagine 30 hours is exciting, but by the time you get to like hour 55...
I mean, you want to blow your brains up.
But you know, I wouldn't suggest going that far, but presumably you're like 6-7 months in and you've not even watched it all and catalogued it all yet at that stage. I mean, was there a point where you just feel, oh, God, I might be in a bit too deep?
You know, to be honest, really, no. I think because the approach that I had held up with the footage, so things were actually flowing. My first cut of the film was probably 4.5 hours long. It was just a massive, unwieldy thing. And so winnowing it down to 1.5 hours was quite a challenge.
But how soon in the process could you stress test it there? Because you just said like it was holding up. Were you conscious like fairly early on that the synopsis that you'd outlined was being backed up by the material that you had?
Yes. There were some wonderful surprises that really were... I knew right away were going to be incredibly compelling elements to the film, which was, I've told the story before, but when the footage all came down, it was just reel after reel after reel. And along with it, there were photographs and documents and reviews from the film and all sorts of stuff. And there was a shoebox, this busted up shoebox, unlabeled. I opened it up, what's this? And there were all these cassette tapes, audio cassette tapes with just dates on them.
Yeah.
Like with a piece of, you know, tape with the data written on it. And I was like, what the hell is this? And I put that, we had a boom box, and I put it into the boom box and played it. And it was Ellie had recorded Francis late at night ranting and bemoaning and this project that he thought was a disaster. And right then I knew, okay, I have the film now, because this is something nobody has ever heard, an artist in the throes of making one of the greatest films, one of the greatest pieces of work that they've done. And in utter despair. So once I got all those, had those transcribed and started to sort of lay those out, they yeah. became the spine of the film.
Interesting. And you were working with George Hickenlooper, the co-director and co-writer. So what was yours and George's relationship? How did you come together?
George came in later. I was simultaneously, and again, this goes to the sort of the schizophrenic nature of my career, but...
Love your career. Yeah,
I mean... I was doing the documentary and was probably close to a year into it. Everything had been logged and I was cutting away. And I got hired to be a staff writer on In Living Color, which was a sketch show, TV show, like a hip hop sketch comedy show. So, and of course, you know, I think I made like $10,000 on Hearts of Darkness. So I was desperately poor.
Yeah.
And this was a union gig. I went to George Zaloom, the producer, and said, can I do this? And he said, sure, go ahead, go for it. And it was crazy because I was in the jungles of Vietnam from 6 a.m. till 10. And then I would drive over to the studio and pitch Homie the Clown sketches for, you know, until like 2 a.m. and then go back to the editing room. And I basically, it was just such a time commitment that I was falling behind. And so we brought a second editor and George in to help complete the project.
Max, I've decided that you're Michael J. Fox doing the first Back to the Future film.
That's right.
That was the one, wasn't it, where he had to shoot a sitcom during the day.
That's right, yeah.
And make Back to the Future at night.
That's right.
I mean, you put in one sentence there, you were aware you were falling behind. Was there a deadline on this once Francis Ford Coppola and Eleanor Coppola had said to go for it?
No, but there was a budget.
Understood, yeah.
And, you know, because it was because we were taking longer than expected, we were worried about going over budgets. We're like, we got to do something. And they were like, don't quit In Living Color, keep going. Let's just bring George in. And he'd just done a behind the scenes documentary. And so, and we'll have him work with a second editor, Jay Miracle, who's an excellent editor.
But when other people are coming in, it's still at the heart of it, this core synopsis that you mapped out right at the very start of it.
Yeah. We stuck with that. I mean, George found some wonderful things and expanded on the story. And definitely, he was a very good filmmaker, but, we pretty much stuck with the outline.
Oh, I'm disappointed, Fax. I wanted stories of punch-ups behind the scenes and raging arguments in the car park. you kind of let me down there. I mean, we've hinted at the eclectic nature of your career, just so listeners know. I mean, you've gone on to work on things like Jackass and Bad Grandpa, and you've gone back to documentary in more recent times. I'm just curious where your bones are, really. Have you got a kind of area of filmmaking you consider your natural home?
Look, I don't think anybody should ever follow the career trajectory I've had, because I did not pick a lane, for sure. To me, though, it's all storytelling.
Yeah.
So whether it's a sketch or a documentary or comedy feature film or a drama, I mean, it's all just different formats of telling a story. So I wouldn't recommend it. I'm not sure it was the wisest choice, but it's the path I took. So.
Would you not recommend it? I mean, it's worked, hasn't it? It's worked for you.
Yeah, it's worked for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got ADHD, so
no, I get that.
To pop around from thing to thing.
No, I understand that. I'm there. In terms of, I mean, you talked about a 4.5-hour original assembly cut of Hearts of Dance. You talked about the 80 hours of material that you sought through. I think what's sometimes lost in the story is you also went out and filmed new material for this as well. So at the point you're looking at the 4.5 hours, are you as much seeing things that you're missing as well as what you've got too much of?
No. I mean, no. We would have loved an interview with Brando and Harvey Keitel, because they were such important parts of the story. But there was so much good material that I never felt like, oh, I'm lacking something.
Yeah. But was there anything in the discovery of it that was maybe surprising you as well? I mean, you've hinted at that a little bit. It's just like, if we compare the synopsis to what was in that 4.5 hours, what would you have not in a million years thought would be on that piece of paper?
Well, in the film, something I had no idea of was the sacrifice of the pigs. And they go with the indigenous people and they experience their sacrificing the pigs. And then And they kill the caribou, which is where Francis gets the idea of doing the sacrifice at the end of the film, because Elliot asked him to come to this, and Francis saw it and then incorporated it into the film. The chief hands them the heart. And I thought, oh my, that is Hearts of Darkness. I mean, it's just was the perfect sort of climax to our film.
As Francis and I were getting ready to leave, the mayor asked if we would do the priest the honor of accepting the best part of the caribou that is usually reserved for him, the heart. We thanked him.
I think it's also fair to say around the time of the release, it was the moment we knew about before we'd seen the film, that sometimes you get that with a film. That there was a part of the discourse that immediately latched onto that and almost shielded what the rest of it was about. What do you remember about that release period and that initial conversation around the film? And then I'm going to come to Cannes. I want to ask you Cannes questions.
Well, that really was the premiere, was Cannes. We had made the film Showtime, actually. It was a cable-funded project.
Yeah,
it was supposed to premiere on Showtime, but I think Francis and Ellie took it to Gilles Jacob at Cannes. And so that was the premiere. It had never been screened before. And so, you know, as a young filmmaker, I was like, this is unbelievable dream to have really the first feature film that I'd made premiere at Cannes. And it was just, you know, otherworldly.
What's more otherworldly, a Cannes premiere or showing your first version of the film to Eleanor Coppola and Francis Ford Coppola?
Yeah, it was terrifying to show it to Francis and Ellie, of course. You know, they really hadn't seen, I mean, it had shown segments to Ellie to get her feedback and she gave wonderful notes, but they were really not, they didn't come to the editing room, they didn't ask to see early cuts or whatever, they just wanted to see the film when it was finished. And I was terrified, and I sat literally right behind Francis. And the whole time I was just, and he was taking notes and I was trying to read his notes and I was, you know, heart pounding. Does he hate it? Does he hate it? Does he hate it? And projector stops, lights come up. Francis sits there for a minute. And at the time I had had another actress read Eleanor Coppola's notes passages, the passages from her book. Very good actress. She did a great job. But Francis said, well, I like it. And he goes, I'd give you an A on the film if you get rid of that actress and have Ellie read her own, you know, passages from her book, because what are you thinking? I mean, it's, you know, it's so inauthentic. And I was like, oh my God, of course, why didn't I think of that? And immediately, you know, we went and recorded Ellie, and it worked so well. She did such a beautiful job with it.
I'm still stuck at the bit where he looks you in the eye and says, I'll give you an A, but.
I know, which was just so, I was so happy. It's like whenever you get an A, and from Francis.
I couldn't tell you, I've never had one, but I'll take your word. I'll take your word for it. I mean, Francis has talked to us and with a calmness and a perspective on the film and on the loss of Eleanor Coppola as well, and how he looks back at it. And to hear him talk of Apocalypse Now and Hearts of Darkness Now is a calm man reflecting on his work. Clearly, Apocalypse Now was not a calm man in the midst of his work, and he's been, you know, open about that. Where was he in the midst of Hearts of Darkness? Because presumably he was prepping Bram Stoker's Dracula around the same time, so he was juggling lots of stuff. Was he sanguine? Was he able to look back with some perspective on it, or was kind of like giving him shivers?
Oh, no, he was... First of all, my first interview with him, which I did at his estate up in Napa.
I hope you got wine facts.
Oh, we did. We got wine after. but he rolled up to do the interview, having been in San Francisco pulling an all-nighter, cutting Godfather 3. And he was furious because Paramount was making him release it at Christmas. And this was like in October, so we had very little time to do it. So he was in a really grumpy mood to begin with. And so he sits down and I start asking him these questions, and he got quite pissed off at me because he was like, at one point he said, I said something like, you know, why did you decide to go and shoot the film when you didn't have the ending done? Was that, you know, a good choice? Did you think that was a good choice? And he goes, what is this, some fucking college kid or something asking me these stupid questions? You know, he didn't want to deal with that. So it was, you know, really touch and go there. But, and afterwards I was like, oh my God, he's going to fire me from the project. He hates me now. But it turned out to be really the better of the two interviews because he's so lively. I mean, he says the thing about the fat girl in Ohio using her daddy's camcorder to make a masterpiece. And then he gets up and walks out. That was the end of the interview. And it's one of the greatest.
It's great cinema.
It's great cinema. Yeah.
I have to ask you, I mean, there's a new 4K set of Hearts of Darkness coming out. And I looked at the listing of extra features. How do you feel that there is a making of Hearts of Darkness on the Hearts of Darkness Blu-ray disc? I mean, that's kind of going around in circles to a degree, isn't it? And yet
it's
the
quite
story
meta.
Of the making of it is quite something. Are we going to look forward to a making of the making of? Do you
think? We'll see. We'll see. I will talk to those guys about that.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because it goes to the footprint of the film. Because you, I mean, you talked there about a Cannes premiere, and you're a 30-something first-time filmmaker getting what Gene Siskel's Film of the Year with your first film. This weight of cinema history on your shoulders as well with Apocalypse Now. And then you must look at like something like Tropic Thunder or something and just want to send an invoice. Allegedly, how do you feel about the footprint of the film? I mean, the fact that we're talking about effectively a making of film that stood alone in its own right for over 30 years.
Extremely proud of the film. You know, it was just a real highlight of my life. My career, for sure. I think the highest compliments that I get are you can't know Apocalypse Now until you've seen Hearts of Darkness. I think it's a must see addendum to one of the great American films. So I was, you know, very proud of it, and, you know, grateful that Francis and Ellie gave me this opportunity.
I'm still curious at the idea of the 4.5-hour cut. I like the idea that you could, I mean, Apocalypse Now has had three different cuts to date. I mean, if you're following the template, could we get a redux version?
Possibly.
Tempted to go back and have another look?
I would be. I would love to see that footage again. Why the film was 4.5 hours is Ellie shot both pre-production and post-production. And so those were all elements of my original 4-hour cut. And it was recording the narration with Martin Sheen, and Michael Hare was there in the room, like writing new lines for Sheen to try. And one of the crazy people in the editing team stealing the film, stealing the work print, because he was furious with Francis for some reason, some creative dispute or something. And he literally like drove the work print to Reno or something and holed up in a motel and started cutting up old footage from something else, but telling and sending it in envelopes saying, I'm destroying your work print day by day until I get an apology from Francis. Like just crazy stories like that. So yeah, absolutely. I would love to go back in and explore those.
Facts. I think we're joining forces on a mini series now. I think that's what we've got out of this podcast interview, that we now have a new creative union on this.
Amen.
I mean, just to round it off, I mean, it's an extraordinary story and it's an extraordinary film. It's the obvious question, really. I just wonder, how do you reflect on it? You know, and you have had this terrific eclectic career. You have gone back to documentary as well. But I'm just curious, in your body of work, in your life, in the stuff that you've put into the world, how do you feel about it?
Oh, it's, I would say, the best thing I've ever done. I really think the film holds up.
Yeah.
Some work of mine, you know, it's like it's of its time and it doesn't last. But this, I think, is a solid piece of work that I think will hold up.
I think you're underselling yourself a bit there, Fax, but I admire your modesty. I think if I'd have made Hearts of Darkness a filmmaker's apocalypse, I would have a drum kit out now and I would be banging it very, very, very loud. It's been a real delight to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Huge congratulations on this film that's just endured and continues to endure. It's terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for having me.
The new 3-disc set of Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, is on sale from the 28th of July 2025, and the film is also currently back in cinemas. For this episode, huge thanks though to Francis Ford Coppola and Fax Barr. Interviews were done by myself and Alison Arbour, and the episode, as always, has been produced by Queenie Qureshi Wales. I'll be back soon with the next regular episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram, and TikTok. Till the next time, ta-ta for now.